Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Jim and Austin, a lot's been happening in North Africa. We've reported on some things in Algeria. Austin has an excellent column on Egypt this week. The focus has been on Egypt.
Tunisia the week before. Right.
The whole North Africa seems to be a little bit in turmoil, and this has been building up for some time, right, Jim?
The problems in Tunisia and Egypt go back centuries. The basic problem is that none of these countries have had any exposure to democracy or to what we take for granted in the West, what we call, you know, liberal government. In other words, a government that pays attention to the people, serves the people. Many people, after the Arab countries became technically republics or democracies after World War II, after World War I, old Eastern hands described them as tribes with flags. Your basic problem in the Arab world is that there is no sense of what we call and take for granted is a civil society. In other words, where you have public servants, people who take seriously, you know, not just mouthing the platitudes, you know, civil service. I'm a servant of the people. Arabs, you know, picked up the idea, but not the actual execution. So you will have a lot of these Arab leaders, you know, sounding like a Western politician, but not acting like one. I mean, one thing that surprises Arabs that migrate to the United States, once they look around and get to know the place, they're amazed at how many American politicians are sent to jail. They're prosecuted. And that is unknown. That just doesn't happen back home. And so you have a situation in Tunisia and Egypt where, you know, the media gives the impression that, you know, the people are rising up and they're getting rid of the bad. I mean, President Ben Ali has fled Tunisia, and Mubarak's already been making concessions. He said he's not going to run for re-election, and these are basically very much arranged elections, controlled elections, you know, next year. But what the people understand the way it works. They've had plenty of time to compare their situation with the way it works in the West, not just by, you know, the miracle of the internet, but a lot of them have migrated. You know, Egypt has billions of dollars a year coming back in. I think it's $7-8 billion a year coming back in remittances. You know, millions of families get a large chunk of their income from their like family members overseas. And those in the West, you know, they get on Skype, you know, it's cheap to talk, and they say, what's going on over there? And they explain the way things work in the West, and they say, that's amazing, why can't we do that here? And, you know, the new younger generation is saying, yeah, let's do something about it. I mean, our parents talked about it. Isn't it wonderful the way they run things over in Sweden or America or Britain or what have you? Why can't we do that here? They want to do it, but what they're finding out is that the people who are on top to control politics and especially the economy and the military, they don't want to give that up. We saw that in Iraq, you know, with Saddam, although, you know, the American media, the Western media sort of played that down because, you know, Bush was evil and the invasion was evil and nothing good came out of it. But you basically had your typical Arab, you know, oligarchy, dictatorship. And it's not enough just to get rid of the president, which people are still calling for in Egypt. But, for example, Mubarak's son, who is the heir apparent, he's being groomed, you know, very openly to, you know, run, you know, in the next election, which Mubarak Sr. has said he's not going to run for re-election, which is very disingenuous. I mean, the Egyptians, they know this. And they know that it's not just Mubarak has to go, but, you know, hundreds of, you know, assistant thieves, in addition to the big thief, have to go. And they also want justice. They want to get some of that money back. And it's the trouble is that because the, like Egypt, for example, hasn't been ruled by Egyptians, well, wasn't until the 1950s, since the time of Alexander. And since then, all they've had are basically crooks. you know, people who said the right things, but the minute they got in power, they basically turned it into a patronage state, where the only purpose of the supreme ruler was to keep him and his crowd in power. And this is not what you get in the West. And the people in the, especially the younger generation in the Arab world, who are largely well-educated and unemployed, very dangerous combination, they want to change that, and a lot of them aren't exactly sure how. And that's why people in the State Department are having heart palpitations right about now, because they have lists of the various political groups, you know, not just the Muslim Brotherhood and the various leftist groups and what have you, and they're looking at what's happened in other countries, like in Iraq. You look at the mess you got there. You look in Afghanistan, which is a different situation. That's much more tribal. There aren't that many political parties as in the sense that in the West or in the Arab world, where they have picked up on that kind of party politics. And they're wondering, you know, where it's all going to end. And a lot of people have a sense that it's not going to end well. And we're probably not going to know for another few months.
Right. Now, Austin, what are the chances that this movement spills over into Jordan, Saudi Arabia, other countries?
Well, Dan, I'd rather approach that issue from a different angle.
Okay.
First of all, it's true to describe the brittleness of dictatorship. It's also a brittleness of monarchies as well. So there is always the lurking chance, in the authoritarian monarchy versus a constitutional monarchy like you have in the United Kingdom, where the kings and queens are really sort of come-ons for tourists. But that's not the case. And let's talk about Jordan and Morocco here in a moment. The reason I say that is that in those types of socio-political structures, the chance of a revolt, it's always there. It's in part of the way that the monarchs and the strongman authoritarian leaders and moving grading on into the dictators have security apparatuses that are designed to oppress and suppress and their own population. It's not precisely a change, because you can see how electronic information, both radio and television, played a role in ending the Cold War. East Germans watching West German TV, despite the attempts by East German government to keep their antennas from being able to pick up West German television, and now East Germans understood what West Germany was about. You also had the phenomenon in the late 1980s and into the 1990s of satellite dishes cropping up in what were Soviet Union socialist republics, now Ukraine, Belarus, Caucasus, Kazakhstan. So this understanding what the greater world is like. That's also taken a look in the Middle East and across North Africa. The population are better attuned to what the rest of the world is like. And as Jim noted, communications in and out of countries. Egypt relies on remittances. It has a lot of overseas population, a lot of them living in Western Europe, a number here in the United States. So they understand how these Western-oriented liberal democracies work, ultimately, in some cases, work to the benefit, to serve the population, rather than as Jim had a post up about 3 weeks ago, I think, in Asia. He described how really what you have are kleptocratic states where the ruler, whether king or dictator, has a clique around him, often family members, and certainly the ties to the wealthiest families, many of these families that have can trace their merchant and trading connections back centuries. This is what the society then is serving serving the ruling. So the awareness by the population in general, because they can, the internet, Skype communications, tweets, cell phones, and the like, is that, hey, we are not, we're tired of being marginalized in our own country and brutalized. As Jim had pointed out, too, Tunisia is a little bit different. Every fact is, every one of these countries across North Africa, and that's really where you started the conversation today, Dan, was on North Africa, are different in many ways. Demographically, a high level of education in Tunisia, that's something we pointed out a few weeks ago on strategy page, and certainly pointed that out in that column I wrote a couple of weeks ago about the Tunisian a Tunisian rebellion, and they're educated folks, they don't have jobs. Egypt, reasonable level, there's an educated elite and a lot of educated individuals with college and technical training that don't have jobs, unemployment problem, there's a connection there with Tunisia. As Jim Dawson pointed out, look, Libya's really an absolute dictatorship, and Gaddafi is an extremely adept and brutal leader. I haven't heard much out of Libya. Algeria, complex place, extremely complex, with a large Berber population that has Arabs overran the strip along the North African coast really 1,200 years ago. But they still, the back country, in particular Algeria, they have the Berber people who are resent the Arabs. And, they're arguably only nominally Muslim. There you have, we've covered this on strategy page in depth, a situation where the government, which is largely Franco-Arab, remember Algeria, like Tunisia, were French colonies for really a couple of hundred years, put down the Armed Islamic Group, GIA, the French acronym, that launched an attempted Islamic revolution. That was going on in the 1990s. I'm sure they're disturbed, but they're also, that's a pretty intelligent group that runs the government in the dictatorship in Algeria. Now, I get over to Morocco. I've gone right across North Africa. We're into the Maghreb. By the way, and we write about this on strategy page. AQIM, or sometimes AQM, Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. That's an Al-Qaeda affiliate that is dedicated to the Al-Qaeda brand of global caliphate, then toppling Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, and Morocco. Point out a couple of things now about Morocco and Jordan. They're both of the ruling families there trace their lineage back to Muhammad. That gives you a bit of an inoculation against certain types of militant Islamists. And the Moroccan their Fatimids, meaning they claim their descent from Muhammad's daughter. Fatima, they run an unusual kind of government there in Morocco. Tourists are welcome to come in. Tourists are welcome to party. You can read and most anything you want, but you cannot question the absolute authority of the monarch. And so they have a pretty effective internal security operation there in Morocco as well. But shifted back, I'll tell you, Dan, how Egypt evolves. And I know the revolution, evolution, but how the rebellion evolves over the next 5 or 6 months is going to tell us a lot about that's where we'll actually be able to say something more directly to answer your question about the potential for the toppling of regimes in the Arabian Peninsula and elsewhere in the classic Middle East, Syria, as an example. Even though that is one dictatorship run by the Alawites, the Assad clan, but they're all from the Alawite religious minority. But they've already responded in some ways to the Egyptian revolt, at least talking about some type of lifting the level of lessening the level of oppression within Syria, because Egypt is really a fulcrum of the Arab world. It looks like that geographically. That's right there, the Maghreb, the North Africa that proceeds to the west. And it is a large population. And what happens in Egypt will have immediate resonance throughout the rest of the Arab Muslim world. So what do I think is going to happen? To encourage folks to take a look at the column that showed up on strategy page this week about how we had a Menshevik Islamist versus Bolshevik Islamist. If Mubarak manages to ride it out to the fall, as he says, to the fall elections, and the elections are, this is a very iffy statement I'm about to make, the elections are reasonably fair, and you see a democratic front coalesce and stay together that involves elements of the military, progressive elements of the military, secularists in Egypt, and what we call moderate Islamists, and there are lots of flavors of these. They're Muslims who advocate Quranic values in the statutory law, and they look to the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, which is a quote-unquote moderate Islamist party, as an example of participating in democratic politics. How that's this conglomerate front, democratic front, holds together under the guaranteed attack by Al-Qaeda and Muslim extremists within the Muslim Brotherhood is something we don't know. And how the military holds together, because there's we're seeing right now at least some military units in Cairo that are letting the counter-demonstrators, the pro-Mubarak counter-demonstrators, fight it out with the democratic protesters, much to the shock of many in Egypt and a lot in the Western press. I think the fact that the military initially said that they would not fire on peaceful demonstrators is indicative of, and Jim alluded to this, of the generals following the privates, because the troops didn't want to shoot. And the generals wisely said, hey, we're not going to do that. But the counter pro-Mubarak forces that showed up with their camels and horses in Cairo this week to challenge the other demonstrators, they're letting this push and shove and riots continue, at least some of the military forces are. Whether that's indicative of a split within the military forces, time's going to tell. I certainly hope that the Egyptian military operates on some degree of a consensus basis and knows that Mubarak's time is up. The question is the time, did they recognize that the time is up for the kleptocratic system that Jim describes, where the political elites are in bed with the economic elites and run a corruption machine that the rest of the folks no longer are willing to put up with?
Yeah. Now, Jim, probably one of the things that may have the most impact on the West is the Suez Canal and what happens there. What are the threats and what are the potentialities there?
Well, there really isn't a threat, because the Suez Canal brings in, I think it's $5 or $6 billion a year in revenue. And that's pretty good money because it's easy to steal. You know, the expenses are not that high. Of course, the world economy is concerned about that because if the Suez Canal is closed for any reason, you know, the cost of shipping goes up substantially, you know, on many key routes. So it's in everybody's interest in Egypt to keep the canal open. The big problem in Egypt and every Arab country is that the dictator stays in power by keeping key people well employed, well paid, shall we say. So the officer corps in Egypt, the senior civil service, the key ministers, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people in Egypt, and a lesser number in even Yemen has its patronage. I mean, that's, we understand, we have a word for it in the United States, patronage, and throughout most of the country there are a lot of laws making it difficult, not impossible, but difficult for politicians to basically wholesale replace, civil servants who do have a useful function to perform, with political hacks. I mean, for example, in a way Americans can understand, one reason why India has, very low literacy, I think it's only 60-70%. I mean, for a country that's been exposed to Western culture as long as India has, it has a lot of illiterate people. The reason is teaching jobs are patronage jobs. You give them out to your political supporters, your key political supporters. As a result, a lot of teachers don't know what they're doing, or a lot of them don't even show up except to pick up their paycheck, the pay every month. So a lot of children simply do not get educated. This is not the case in communist China, where they have a slightly different attitude towards patronage. You're expected to not only support, there's only one political party. I guess that's the easiest way to explain it. There's no competing interest. And if you're a teacher, teach. And throughout the West, teachers by and large teach. But in a lot of other countries that are having economic and social problems, teaching jobs are like every other government job. It's something of a reward for somebody who will support you and do things for you, up to and including murder. You read some of the local Indian newspapers, and Chicago in its worst days in the 1920s and 30s has nothing on some parts of India. And Indians are well aware of it. I mean, they've been on the rampage against corruption big time for the last couple of decades, and it's only going to get worse as you have more middle-class Indians who have something to lose. So your problem is not just replacing one or a few people, it's replacing thousands. And how do you do that, especially when a lot of them have guns? So what you're seeing in Tunisia and Egypt is only the first act of a very, very long, process. And it could go on for, it will go on for years, assuming it keeps going and isn't stopped in its tracks. And I should point out that there are other, there are many examples. For example, the Philippines, when the people rose up and you had, they threw out Marcos and what have you. Well, the new guy, the son of a previous president who had corruption problems, is still fighting corruption. And this is 20 years later. So, there's no quick fix for this, and there's going to be a lot of chaos in between.
Yeah. Now, Austin, there's been some concern expressed by Israel about what's going on. I know some of the media has sort of indicated, new military threat to Israel and like that. But the real threat isn't it what will happen on the Gaza border. The Egyptian military itself will be in disorder for some time if something happens.
Well, I'm not sure what the Egyptian military is going to look like in a year. There's going to be a internal focus. There is right now an Egyptian security services, and that's going to take, that's going to be the first order of business. That's job one. That said, Egypt and Israel have, to a remarkable degree, despite, and I'm going to go over to the side here, we covered a corruption in the Sinai, because there's all kinds of things that can get smuggled into Gaza and shipped into Gaza for the right price. That's the way of doing business. So Gaza gets access to all kinds of things. It's not a the quote-unquote blockade is extremely porous if you've got the right cash to get the material in there. Now, the thing is, though, that the Egyptian military and security services have been have made attempts to keep the Hamas militants and various other militant organizations that are supported by Hamas within Gaza from coming back into Egypt. Now, I read one report, and it's the kind of speculative report that gets a great headline. You have to wonder where the material came from. It could have been an Israeli source, an Egyptian source, or it could have been just a highly speculative source, but Hamas militants have entered Egypt to provide aid to the hard militant Islamist components of the Muslim Brotherhood. Actually, I think that's probably accurate. I know they have communications. It's just like it's possible to make a phone call quickly from here to the middle of the Sahara Desert and reach someone. It's fairly easy to get a hold of somebody from Gaza on the electronic to Cairo. That said, you'd probably be monitored by the Israelis, if not the United States, and four or five other intelligence agencies of other states. But the movement of militants and arms, how the military and state security respond to that, because that is this fits in with the case I make in a column this week of the militant Islamists willing to kill and kill in mass and undermine the democratic secularists, the modern Islamists that want to model Egypt after Turkey with a democratic system. And modernizers is probably the best way to do it, the anti-corruption, forces of anti-corruption, and usurp that group, which is, I am certain, by far the largest element of the populace, and turn it into an Islamic dictatorship. It sounds vaguely like Iran. It is vaguely like Iran. Iran's a different situation than Iran 1979 and Egypt 2011, but nevertheless, that is what I just described. If you put it into the Russian Revolution terms, it's the Mensheviks, the moderates, rebels being taken over by the Bolsheviks, the hardline, the communist, the hardline communists who are set for to their hit squads and terror and out to first eliminate key members of the old Tsarist state, and then they're going to eliminate their Menshevik rivals. That is the security concern, I believe, of the Egyptian military. How does this affect Israel? Well, of course, if you had an Islamic dictatorship out of Egypt, Israel has a very active front, and we're back to a situation worse than the 1956 or 1967, 1973. I think that's unlikely, Dan, for a number of reasons. Nevertheless, as this revolt proceeds, as Jim said, through time, there are a number of Egyptians who, this is put this in religious context, say that the peace treaty we signed with the Israelis has made us subservient to the money that the United States gives us. That's one way of framing it. So the resentment for the United States, and then this cold, lingering cold resentment for the Israelis, I think that you will see a decrease in between Egypt and Israel. I can suspect the Israelis, from what I've read in the Israeli press, expect to see that. What they don't want is the Egyptians to become an active enemy. I'm not sure that it's, in fact, I know it's not in Egypt's interest to become an enemy of Israel. Egypt really has benefited from their the peace process, the armistice, There are going to be elements in Egypt that are going to try to use Israel as a focus on Israel's the enemy. Muslim Brotherhood member stated that as soon as we take Egypt, we're going to attack the Israelis. I mean, Israelis certainly have to pay attention to the possibility that is what could evolve in Egypt. Again, I want to say that we're going to know more about what that dimension of this, how that dimension of this of Egypt's relation with its neighbors and with Israel in 6 or 7 months after the elections.
Right.
After the elections come on. I think we will know more. And
right.
And that's part of the reason. But look, everything Jim and I have laid out, it's all of those, all the elements are in play. There are lots of reasons, because I want to sit here and sound pessimistic. In some ways I'm not. Pessimistic. But the thing is, also, if you sit there like the talking heads do on TV and say, this is going to happen, you don't know. But folks right now in Cairo, I guarantee you don't know. They don't know what's going to be happening tomorrow.
Right.
And that's, they'll have a clearer picture of it as a cooling off period or a time for a rethinking and rational thought through the fall. And this is why Mubarak's statement, because I believe how likely that he's going to try to run his son or another member of the kleptocracy, but that's still a cooling off period.
Right. I guess the only thing that we probably could say for sure is if there are elections in the fall, that Jimmy Carter will be there to make sure that they're fair.
No.
Okay.
Jimmy Carter was there in 1979 when the Shah fell, wasn't he?
Right.
Yes, he was.
I should point out that one of the big differences between Egypt and, say, Iran is that Iran had a history of clerics meddling in politics.
Yep.
And they and the only reason the clerics got in power, they managed to get a constitution enacted that favored clerical rule, was because of the Iraq invasion. Egypt, on the other hand, has no natural enemies. Assuming, again, Israel has no intention, despite our, paranoia notwithstanding, of invading Egypt again. Libya and Sudan are really incapable. As much as both countries have grievances against Egypt, ancient grievances, neither is competent as Egypt is. And the Egyptian military is basically a jobs program. We've done recent pieces on this. I've been getting a lot of reports from Egypt, before the current, situation developed. Their military is a big mess. So Mubarak knows this. Everybody, Egyptians know this. If the military fell apart, it wouldn't affect the country in terms of national security. What the army is good for is being a kingmaker, because most of the soldiers are basically in favor of change. Most of the officers are inclined to keep their income and stay out of jail or stay alive if things really get testy. So there are a lot of people who are inclined to cooperate. And it's not a very good environment for zealots. The Egyptians basically fought a war with Islamic militants, terrorists, in the 1990s, They are not, they do not like them. Unfortunately, media propaganda has been very anti-Israel for the last 50 years, although a lot of Egyptians know otherwise. It's a question of who's going to be, you know, brave enough to say it, say out loud that the emperor has no clothes when it comes to anti, you know, Israeli propaganda. And right now, there are many groups that would love to take the lead. Mr. Baghdadi, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood. But these people are basically running behind, you know, trying to get in front so they can say they're leading. And, you know, so it's, from a political science point of view, it's very interesting to watch to see if one of these scoundrels can actually pull this off, because it has happened before, it might happen again, and we can only hope that it won't.
Right.
Well, this is what I mean, Dan, about this is a very fascinating time. Not to be clinically detached from it, because you really can't, but what's going on is extremely important and has extraordinary regional resonance. I mean, right on to Saudi Arabia. I don't, interestingly enough, I think Iraq has got its own, drawing its own act together and is in an interesting position of where Iraqis had fled Iraq. They're now coming back because of the destabilization in the rest of the Arab world. But the thing is that there is so much going on, and I'll go back to saying the Egyptians don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. But you know, the little scenario that Jim sketched out about the connivers trying to take control of groups that are, you know, they're behind the events. And he said, you mentioned Mohammed Al-Baradei, didn't you, Jim? And that's one of the
Yeah,
you mentioned Al-Baradei. Yeah, that really was a very apt description of where he is. Al-Baradei wants, you know, he's definitely got aspirations, but it's like, hi, I'm here, I'm ready to lead. And he speaks more to the press, apparently, than he has to the, he's more of a press figure. And, Muslim Brotherhood is surprised by these events. This is not the revolution that they had strived for. You know, they want the angry Al-Qaeda-like overthrow and, you know, grand, glorious, romantic bloodbath. But that's not what's going on. It's something different. It's something kind of like Tunisia. And we're going to know more in the next few months. We've got to talk about it. But the thing is, though, is I've already seen a raft of predictions, Dan, it's too complicated.
Right.
And the thing is, there is an upside. It's going to be a long way to reach it, but there is an upside for the Egyptian people. And ultimately, for Arabs, out of this. That's the thing. You can't, when you hear the downside, and again, I understand the Israeli spirit. It's rational. But the upside is that the revolutionaries in Tunisia, they really had very little to say about Northern Islamism. That's not what they want. They want jobs. They want honesty. They want real public servants, and they want a military that is a public servant, you know, armed services, and not a tool of oppression. Ah, what would be what is the military and the Revolutionary Guards anyway? It's a tool of oppression.
Right.
That's not what's going on. We covered a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
Why don't we pick this up next week?
Right. It's okay. Time to wrap it up, and we'll talk to you next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.